Hey there. Happy Friday. Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy. I want to apologize for all the text messages I was sending you today. Like the long, I kind of felt like my mother-in-law.
It's okay. Who I didn't read them.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. It wasn't just the quantity of texts. It was just like, there were a couple of them that were, you know, paragraphs and paragraphs, which I don't normally do. I just got in my mode and then realized by about text number six that was way too many. And then at that point, I was kind of pot committed and just kept going. So sorry about that.
Yeah, it's fine. If you were asking me to prepare anything for today's show,
you have no idea.
Yeah, I hope that I happen to prepare the things that you were asking for. Because after, look, I know some people text that way. And this isn't the right example of it, but some people, instead of writing you like a paragraph text, will send you several one-line texts. This wasn't that. This was like several paragraph texts. It was like merging the two styles together. It was a lot.
Yeah, so, it was almost like I realized while I was sending the long text that this was inappropriate, so sent it at that point, but then just kept sending more long texts.
It was just
really bad.
Yeah,
and I felt bad about it.
I hit you with the meme, I ain't reading all that, I'm happy for you, or I'm sorry that happened.
All right, but be honest, what would you have preferred? Me to call you and us to have a conversation with our mouths and like words coming out of them and like sound and, you know, in real time, or what I did where you could just gloss over it or ignore it altogether?
Yeah, I am a texter more than a phone caller, but that's especially the case with like, that was not an immediate thing. Like I could look at that anytime between when you sent it and 2 or 3 in the afternoon when I get here.
Yeah. You know what I also noticed about you? Is that you don't even have like voicemail is not even an option with you. Like you just like shut it off completely.
Yeah.
Like don't you have family members? Like my dad loves to leave me some voice messages.
No, if my family, like my mom and dad will both FaceTime me sometimes and my brother will FaceTime me with my little nephew. But like if they don't get an answer, they just send a text if it's important. Otherwise I call them back when, like, not having voicemail doesn't mean I can't see that someone called. I just call them back.
No,
because what's the voicemail going to say? Call me back.
Pretty much. No, sometimes there is a voicemail. I will say, sometimes my dad will leave a voicemail and that's the end of it. I can like text a response and say, yeah, I got your voicemail. We don't need to talk. And yeah, the interaction is over.
I have a friend I have two friends who this might qualify for, but I'm thinking of one friend in specific. I would worry that his dad would leave me voicemails because he will occasionally call me to like talk about the Blue Jays or the Leafs or something like that, or ask for Jays tickets or something.
I will say that, some of my closer friends, if they do have voicemails, sometimes I will intentionally leave a super long voicemail, which I imagine, just like you did with my text, or not listened to the very end. But yeah, it's probably a smart move. Well done with no voicemail. All right, let's get to today's top story, brought to you by Thornhill Toyota, your local Toyota store since 1969. Come for the history, stay for the future. Dufferin North of Steeles, and this might have been what I was texting you about. I don't remember. but the Blue Jays might be all in on Brandon Nimmo. So now there's this fella on Twitter who does not even have, I think, 1,000 Twitter followers. And Twitter might not be a thing by tomorrow. Maybe we'll get into that later on.
Here's the thing. You don't need 1,000 Twitter followers. You don't need 50,000 Twitter followers. If you have been right once, it doesn't matter how many times you've been wrong. It doesn't matter the context of being right. Getting one single scoop right is the flags fly forever of sports media, where there are like very trusted NBA newsbreakers who get way, way, way more wrong than they get right.
Correct.
And every time they get something wrong, people get in a huff about it, and then they forget as soon as the next thing comes because, oh, they got that one thing right that one time.
All right, so here's what we're talking about. It's a fella named Mike Baboa on Twitter. He claims to be a former Mets beat writer. I don't know how much investigating into his former career as the Mets beat writer we've gone down, but yes, he was right about the Kevin Gausman signing. He was like the first on it. For the Blue Jays. Here's his tweet. Brandon Nimmo sweepstakes down to 2. Mets and Blue Jays. We've seen this before with Gausman and Springer. Right now, it's 2 Blue Jays, 0 Mets. The way it looks, Blue Jays aren't going to back down. Whatever it takes to get Brandon Nimmo, Ross Atkins, and ownership are ready. Okay, That's pretty strong. We're talking about an ownership in Steve Cohen, who is the richest in all of Major League Baseball. They had the highest payroll in all of baseball a season ago, $287 million last year. They're already at $184 for 2023. Just re-signed their closer on a $100 million deal, but there's plenty of work to be done. And yeah, one of their aces, Jacob DeGrom, is a free agent right now as well. They got work to do, but they've been beaten twice.
Still a free agent also. Any team could sign him to play their closer out to the mound right now. Timmy Trumpet playing without a contract at the end of last year.
How devastating would that be to bring Edwin Diaz back but not have Timmy Trumpet out there to play him out there when there's a save opportunity? All right, so they have deep, deep pockets, but the Blue Jays have punched him in the mouth in free agency last couple of years. You can't rule it out entirely. I guess the question, though, is should you be spending $150 million on Brandon Nimmo?
Before we get to that part of the question, just for additional context, and like, again, I've been on the news side of things. I've been on the beat writer side. The most logical explanation for Boboa, because there isn't a track record of, like, you can't find articles where he was writing or posting about the Mets. So there is a chance that that's a nothing account and that the odd success that account has had was looking at what the news is, looking at what Fangraphs is projecting or Kylie McDaniel is projecting. We're going to have Eno Saris on later. His recent article had Nimmo at 5-100. You take all of that, you post some stuff, and then you get one or two right, and you delete the other ones.
Yeah,
that's a possibility. The other theory, and this was I don't know if it's still a Blue Jays Reddit theory, but it was after the Gausman thing, is that it's someone's burner.
Yeah.
And that would be interesting, like someone who wants to highlight that the Mets are getting outspent by lesser pocketed teams, even though they had the highest payroll. I like that theory.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Scott Boras doesn't make sense because Kim Gossman's not a Scott Boras guy, so I don't know where that would have come from, and neither is George Springer, I don't believe.
No.
No. Hyunjin Ryu is a Scott Boras guy, but yeah, no, who could that be? I don't know.
It could be anyone, right? Like, it could be someone in the Mets organization. It could be someone who...
Could be Jerry Seinfeld, who's, like, trying to shame the Mets for not spending.
Yeah, it could be Jerry Seinfeld.
I think, okay, that's the theory I'm going with, is that it's Jerry Seinfeld. Either way, he was right once, so yes, we're not dismissing it out of hand. Like, this is
It's
now-
also, we've been kicking around Brandon Nimmo as a name all week, right? Like, since the Teoscar thing happened. So even if this is not substantiated, like, I still think Brandon Nimmo is a name worth discussing. So we can do that. 5-150 is a little rich for my tastes. Like I said, Eno Saris, who we're going to talk to a little later, had it at 5-100. We've seen Jeff Passan of ESPN theorize about the Shin-Soo Choo framework, which was about 6 years, 130. Those are George Springer numbers. Those are really big numbers.
So for context, George Springer signed in free agency with pretty similar numbers approaching free agency to Nimmo. Now, Nimmo has not been the picture of health throughout his entire career. Only twice has played over 100 games in a season.
That's a key part of what I want to talk to Eno about.
Yeah.
Because he was speaking on a podcast recently and passing on research that someone else had done. I think it was Rob Arthur. But basically, we know nothing about injuries and how to predict them. But a player's most recent year is the most predictive thing we have for predicting if they'll be healthy next year. So the fact that Nimmo is coming off of a healthy season is a better predictor than the fact that he had a couple of unhealthy seasons before that.
Yeah, maybe. But he is going to be 30 years old and he has a history of soft tissue injuries, talking about hamstrings, going to play on turf for the first time
too.
Yeah. Like that's not a nothing.
It's scary.
Here's what I'll say though, just to put it out there, that if Brandon Nimmo is healthy and capable of playing center field, which he should be for at least a couple of years, he was an average-ish defender in center field a season ago, but a very good on-base performer, I mean, throughout his entire career, and he hits from the left side, and he's got a little bit of pop, 16 home runs, I think, a season ago. If that's what you're getting, give him the George Springer deal.
What have we seen with Springer? If you get even 130 games of that, you take it and you deal with it the other 30 games. The question then becomes, like, from a risk tolerance perspective, is it better to, you know, have two guys like that, because if they're both healthy in the playoffs, you're unbelievable? Or is it too risky to have two guys like that? On pure terms, if a guy's playing a full season. So my pal Jonah Bierenbaum over at The Score broke down Nimmo and Springer's numbers the four seasons right before their free agency. Remarkably similar.
Yeah, really similar.
Nimmo, a tiny edge in terms of WRC+, which is a stat that accounts for the environment of the league and park factors and things like that. So Nimmo had a slight edge, and Springer had just a tiny edge in wins above replacement per 162 because his defense graded out slightly better, and base running as well.
Well, and I'll do you one better. So, again, injury is such a huge part of it, but if we are saying that your previous season is the most predictive about your ability to stay healthy next year, Fangraphs has a projection system. The Steamer projection system has him projected to be a 4.5 WAR player in 2023, which would lead the Blue Jays in 2022. If he was able to produce that next season, he would have been the most valuable player, like including Bo Bichette, including Vladimir Guerrero Jr., among position players, his 4.5 WAR. If he, of course, produces the way he's projected to produce, that's the best player on the Blue Jays next season.
So I use those Steamer projections for something else.
What's that?
We were kicking around with producer Mike Gentile a little bit before the show about where would Nimmo hit? Would he lead off? I would argue he'd hit second because you break up the righties that way and Springer's entrenched as the leadoff guy. So I ran a little optimizer and I took the lineup that the Blue Jays used for the bulk of the end of last season. So the Springer, Bo, Vlad, Kirk, Teo Chapman as the top six, and then use Gurriel, Jansen, and Aspinall to fill it out. If you want to change one of those, the conclusion here is not going to change much because the 7, 8, 9 in each lineup will be the same. But the way the Jays ran it at the end of last year, if you brought that team back in the same order, based on the Steamer projections, they would be projected to score about 5.13 runs per game. Mm-hmm. Pretty good, right?
Yeah, sounds good.
You drop Nimmo into the two spot, and then I bumped Bo down to four, and then everyone else just slid down a spot into account for Teoscar being gone. So I dropped Nimmo to two, and then instead of Bo and Vlad 3-4, I went Vlad, Bo 3-4, 5.27.
Which is better. That's more.
It's 0.14 runs per game more. You could also, if you wanted to do the like complete nerd optimization, you could get like another degree of better from this lineup, but I don't know that anyone's going to be okay with Gurriel hitting third on the team and Bo hitting seventh, which is what the Steamer projections would suggest. So grains of salt, of course, but that is just a highlight that you drop Nimmo into the middle of this order, even though there's a slugging percentage loss, there's a power loss there, and obviously everyone is very, very fond of Teoscar Hernandez from the human side. Your batting order is stronger with Brendan Nimmo's projections than Teoscar Hernandez's projections.
So this is the thing I kept saying for days after the Teoscar trade, is that the Blue Jays were worse after the trade than they were before. The Blue Jays signed Brendan Nimmo for nothing. They have to give up a draft pick because he was qualified by the Mets. But
yes, and with the Jays' tier of revenue sharing, it would be a second-round pick and $500,000 in international bonus pool money.
Okay, so the Blue Jays signed, let's just play it out. They signed him to the exact same George Springer deal, 6 years, $150 million. In 2023, you now have Eric Swanson and a Brandon Nimmo, no Teoscar Hernandez. I think you're maybe not a lot better, but you're better. And that whole diversity of right-left thing, it's only one guy, but this one guy probably hits, well, he definitely hits in your top three, probably hits two.
And you could argue that, yes, you lose a draft pick, but you picked up Macko in that trade as well.
Mm-hmm.
To not, you know, who knows? He wasn't a second round pick, but he's already made high A and strikes guys out. So he's probably actually more valuable than a second round pick at this stage, given how rarely baseball picks hit. So yeah, you could find your way there. And again, like you just said, that's why the analysis has been, well, this sucks for right now, but wait and see. And then the other element of this would be, well, that Brandon Nimmo contract is a lot more than Teoscar Hernandez was making,
yep,
or was projected to make. So what is the subsequent thing there? Is it, well, you non-tendered or you DFA'd Raimel Tapia, so that's an extra $5 million in the couch cushions there to go toward Nimmo? Or is that, we have to cut somewhere else, and maybe the catching trade decision is, well, Danny Jansen makes a couple million more than these other guys? I don't know. But that would be the other component we have to kind of figure out if Nimmo gets north of 20 in terms of annual value.
All right, last one on this before we move on. This was one of the areas of need for the Blue Jays. If this ends up, again, we're just playing this out, if Brandon Nimmo is the signing. This was getting a little more diverse righty-left, getting a little more on base, getting somebody who could capably play center field was one of the list items this offseason as far as needs for this Blue Jays team. It wasn't the only one, though. One of them was greater rotation depth, and one of them was more swing and miss out of the bullpen. Now, they've done that with Swanson. Swanson struck people out. He doesn't throw 99, but he does, in fact, fit the description of swing and miss out of the bullpen. They have yet to add a starter, but is it likely they were going to go add somebody who was going to compete in the top two with the two guys that they have in Alek Manoah and Kevin Gausman? Probably not. But if this is where you're allocating your resources, because if this is it, it's hard to imagine that there's another massive move coming. Like, it's peripheral stuff, right?
Right. Like, you're even an Andrew Haney, who Ben Nicholson-Smith has said has reported the Jays were pretty interested in, and it remains unsigned. That's a guy who's projected to make low eight figures, but still eight figures. Do you have to then downgrade to maybe Drew Smyly or that type of guy is the guy you're bringing in to compete with Kikuchi and Mitch White for the last couple of rotation spots? Is it even lower than that? And you're doing the old kind of Ricciardi era thing of, well, you're going to have eight or nine guys competing for a couple spots, and you just hope one or two of them click.
So is this the right decision? If this is in fact it, they've decided all the resources or the vast majority of the resources are going towards this one thing. Center fielder who hits from the left side, who gets on base and stays healthy, and not rotation depth and not more bullpen arms. By the way, like, there's already guys that probably have to depart this bullpen as is, right?
No, they got too many of them. They don't have too many good ones. They have too many arms.
Too many.
Like, today is the deadline to tender someone, right? Yes, today is the deadline. So we'll see at some point during the show if the Jays look at Trent Thornton and Trevor Richards and even guys like that who obviously have a use over the course of 162, but they're projected to make a combined $2.6 million, whereas those open 40-man spots would, like, if you pay those guys $1.5 and $1.1 million, you're like a week or two away from having to decide if you just eat that money to DFA them. Mm-hmm. You know, you could obviously outright them if they clear waivers, but yeah. So I wonder if even those two guys are on the fringes of getting an arbitration tender here.
So I would argue that this is the place to spend your capital. I would say that it's not the be-all, end-all, but watching the Phillies get to where they got with basically two starters, right? And Ranger Suarez was good, but they had two top-of-the-line starters in their postseason rotation. The Blue Jays should have three. My God, they're paying Jose Berríos enough to be the third.
We'll talk to Eno Saris about Jose Berríos, too, because Eno's metrics at The Athletic were pretty robust about Berríos heading into this year, and I know Eno's wrote about him, so it'd be interesting to get his perspective at the kind of could he bounce back.
Yeah, and while I have a little bit of a raised eyebrow about Eric Swanson, he does strike people out, and I'd feel more confident in paying less than $2 million for Eric Swanson than whatever, like almost $20 million bucks for Kenley Jansen for 2 years? Like, no thanks. So I think if this is what they're doing, they're using their assets to fill this one spot. I think it's a good use of what you have.
It's also possible that the budget is a little higher than we're maybe anticipating. Last year was the highest payroll in team history, and it projected to be higher this year based on arbitration raises and the way some contracts were structured and things like that. But the Jays still do have a good amount of breathing room below that competitive balance tax line. If they wanted to, or if the economics of baseball suggests that they can,
I think they might
bump from like the 10th or 12th highest payroll to like the 8th highest payroll, or the 10th and 12th highest payroll is just like a $200 million payroll now. Maybe there is a little bit more to come there. I would be pretty uncomfortable going into the season. And of course, it's November 18th, so there's more to come. But with Mitch White and Yusei Kikuchi, like, in rotation spots.
No, that's not what you want. There's going to be some rotation depth added, but yeah, we'll see the quality of that, especially if they're spending north of $20 million on Brandon Nimmo. We'll see. We're watching you, Mike Boboa. But that was today's top story, brought to you by Thornhill Toyota. Leafs lose in overtime again. That's what they do. 3-2 to the Devils yesterday. The Devils cannot be stopped. 11 straight. They're quite good, and you saw it firsthand, really. I mean, the Leafs were lucky to salvage a point out of that thing with the great snipe, William Nylander. So here's
he had a game. He was everywhere last night.
Yeah.
Nice to see.
Yeah, would have been interesting to see him 3-on-3, see if he could have carried that over into the extra period.
Well, but I'll tell you who I don't want to see is a three-man group at 3-on-3, and they weren't the culprits last night, but
yeah, we'll get to that in just a second. I do want to start the Leafs conversation with this. Leafs are they're struggling to score. Okay, which is not what you necessarily anticipated out of the 2022-23 Toronto Maple Leafs. The 25th in goals per game, 26th in 5-on-5 goals per game. Like, Auston Matthews basically has not scored 5-on-5. He has just 2 5-on-5 goals.
He should score more of those.
Yeah, it would have been, a smart move to do that. Only 1 5-on-5 goal in his last 16. So
he scored 44 even strength goals last year. Like, yeah. That's obviously, the Leafs have had a really good power play the last couple of years, but it's pretty remarkable that, like, three seasons running, Matthews led the league in 5-on-5 goals. It's not like him being in the Rocket conversation every year is not a product of just power play. He is the best 5-on-5 goal scorer over the last 3 years.
Over his entire career since he stepped foot on a National Hockey League ice surface, nobody has scored more 5-on-5 goals than Auston freaking Matthews. So that will naturally increase. But he's only one man, right? Like,
as far as I know.
Yes. And certainly not going to shoot 3% for the whole season. I understand that. But Maple Leafs have been pretty good at also limiting goals against this season. So this is the conversation we had with Frank Saravelli the other day, and he like kind of scoffed at my idea about this team maybe needing to look at improving its offense and maybe looking at a forward instead of a defenseman. He said defenseman.
But he also, the week before that when he came on with us, was goalie. So, right. And look, Frank knows, and that piece that he put out the morning after he was on with us made a really good case for a couple of those defensemen, especially the ones who can move the puck a little bit or contribute on the power play like a Klingberg. But right now, this team's issues are primarily on offense, and I pulled some numbers. Last year, of course, they were very, very good offensively, not just scoring, but dominating possession, putting defenses in uncomfortable spots by volume. So last year, they were top six in Corsi per 60, shots per 60, expected goals per 60, high danger scoring chances per 60, basically any way you want to cut it except for maybe shooting percentage, which they were just like slightly above average. They were extremely good. This year, they're very pedestrian across the board. The 15th in shot attempts per 60, 15th in actual shots on net, 26th in shooting percentage.
Yeah.
And then even something like expected goals that I know Leaf fans will sometimes roll their eyes at when it's like, oh, they got goal lead, their expected goals was this or whatever. They're not even doing that well in the expected goals stuff. Like even the nerd stuff I'd turn to isn't painting them in the nicest of lights. And that's on five. That's at 5-on-5. This is also a power play that last year was one of the best in the league. Over the last couple years has ebbed and flowed, but they've dropped from like a top five power play to a below average power play. 21st in power play time. So they're not drawing as many penalties. 21st in shot attempts per 60 on the power play, and they're still getting high danger chances, but not enough when they're on the power play. So this is not just a 5-on-5 issue. It's kind of an up and down. They're just not creating as many opportunities for themselves to score as they have in years past. And, you know, talking to Shayna Goldman yesterday, reading her piece about the Devils and a couple other teams that are really thriving defensively because their offense stays aggressive. We saw it last night in the third period. New Jersey's approach when they were up one against the Leafs was not to lay back and go five wide across the blue line and keep the Leafs from going in. It was, no, if we dominate the possession and the Leafs are in their own end, guess where you can't score from to tie the game? You would think, given what the Leafs have done well offensively the last couple of years and that they've gotten better defensively, if not by personnel, then by results so far this year, this doesn't really line up to me. I would have thought that the defense improving made the offense even better, and we haven't seen that so far.
No, we haven't. We've also seen a very skilled team suck in the skills competition. They haven't gotten to the ultimate skills competition, which is a shootout, because nobody gets there anymore, because 3-on-3 is fun.
Yeah.
It's been a great way to end hockey games, whether it's a true indication of who the better hockey team is.
Sometimes I forget the shootout exists.
Yeah, as you should. But the Leafs now 1-3 in overtime this season. So we talked.
It's worse than that, by the way. It's they're 7-14 in the Keith era.
Yeah, that's not
that's
very
excluding
good.
Shootouts, because they went to 4 shootouts in that stretch too.
So. All right, but yeah, we talked about it. I guess it was last week that when Morgan Rielly, Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner on the ice in the 3-on-3 over the last 3 years, they've been outscored 8-1. Mm-hmm. Now those three weren't on the ice yesterday. Notably, William Nylander wasn't on the ice. It was John Tavares, Mitch Marner, and Morgan Rielly. I mean, you would think that a team, again, with this much skill would be scoring more, but also would be more successful in this 3-on-3 thing.
I don't want to hang it on one person, because any of the data at 3-on-3, like, we're talking, you're piling a bunch of small samples on top of each other, so grain of salt here again, but among players with 25 minutes of 3-on-3 tie game ice time the last 3 years, Morgan Rielly is 143rd out of 147 in basically the possession metrics. How often the Leafs are getting shots relative or chances relative to the opponent. And where that gets especially striking is when you look at, well, of course, Morgan Rielly's played a lot of those minutes with Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner. And maybe it's just there's something with the three of them together that doesn't work at 3-on-3. When those three are out there, they get fewer than 40% of the shot attempts in 3-on-3 play. If you have Matthews and or Marner without Rielly, that jumps to almost 68%. So we're talking about a huge swing from getting absolutely dominated in the possession game to absolutely dominating in the possession game. And again, we're talking about 30, 35 minutes of play over 3 seasons. Maybe it means nothing.
Yeah, but that's but 3 seasons. That's actually it's a also, significant amount of 3-on-3.
And it's such an extreme outlier. Yeah. Like, there aren't really many trios that get this kind of ice time and have those kind of results. It's a little troubling. I don't know that I'd be turning to that trio for a little while. I might try some other
Well, he
some
did
other
it.
Units.
That's why I was going to give Sheldon Keefe all the credit in the world.
Well, he went to 2/3 of it.
Yeah, he sure did. But it seems like it's the 1/3 of it that is the problem. And not that Morgan Rielly's a bad player, but like when you talk about those two guys being independent of the one guy and him being like the worst 3-on-3 player over the last 3 years.
And it's frustrating because he's their best skater and like passer. Yeah. Like, this is,
I'm not asking you to make it make sense. I'm just asking you for the truth. And that's the truth, damn it.
We know that he's not the most stout, even strength defensive player, and that's okay given his offensive value and his rush value and stuff. And what he means to the team from like a personality and leadership perspective. But yeah, I don't know. I got to sit down with it more and maybe get Bourne to pull me some tape or something like that. But there's something there over 3 seasons worth of data that group and Morgan Rielly in particular doesn't work in those situations, or right. It hasn't worked.
So let's, next 3-on-3 overtime, because I would like to think that part of the reason, and I understand the forward groupings had been broken up anyway, so it was unlikely that he would, play Marner and Matthews apart from each other throughout the course of the whole game and then put them back together for overtime. But yeah, he didn't have those two back together for overtime. The trio that had been scored against 8-1 over the last 3 years was not together. But man, and then how weird is it going to look? And how many people are going to have some serious post-game questions about, I don't know, Justin Hall being the defenseman out there in overtime, which it wouldn't be, but yeah.
Yeah. So there's one thing that hangs over all of this. And again, the sample sizes and everything. And who knows, maybe if I get Bourne to go pull the tape for me on Monday or something like that, we see why this is the case and it can't be blamed on the goalies. That trio has also gotten ridiculously unlucky goaltending, like lower than a 50% save percentage.
Mm. Well, and
that's a chicken or egg thing. Like, are they losing these minutes because the goaltending's not there, or is the goaltending not there because they're giving up a lot of really high yield chances? I don't know. Again, I just did the stats dive today. I got to do the tape dive on the weekend.
Yeah, get into the lab on the weekend. I
know how to do this for basketball and baseball. I got to ask Bourne, how do I get the like all 22 NFL style stuff for the NHL?
All right. That's coming next week. All right. Coming up next, though, we'll get back into the potential of Brandon Nimmo being the Blue Jays center fielder in 2023. We'll talk to our pal Eno Saris of The Athletic next as the Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Blake Murphy. And you may not think that $100 million is a bargain, but yeah, for Brandon Nimmo, it might end up being. And that might not be what the final tab comes down as. Let's talk to Eno Saris of The Athletic, who has Brandon Nimmo on his list of the best free agent bargains of the offseason. But you had him, at 5 years, $100 million. I mean, at what point does that become not a bargain?
I have heard the rumors. Ellen, hey, thanks for having me. good to see you again, Blake. I've heard the rumors that it's $130 million for 6 years. And I just recently ran the numbers, as you said, at 5 years and $100 million, and said he'd be one of the best, dollars per win. Budget acquisitions actually at that at 6 and 130 he's still in the top 10, and basically you're spending under $7 million a win by the projections if you get him on that deal, and the normal going rate right now is $8 to $9 million, so still a good deal and still a really decent upgrade over Teoscar Hernandez. And I know it's sometimes hard to see it because Teoscar Hernandez hit the ball super hard and hit all a bunch of homers. And those are the things that we remember when we watch someone play. But Brandon Nimmo gets on base like nobody's business. The second best projection for on base percentage among free agents. And he also plays good center field defense with Teoscar. I would think he's pretty much a DH at this point. So I have Nimmo as a 2.5 win upgrade over Teoscar Hernandez in year one, and a better candidate for a long-term deal like this.
That's before even getting into the fact, and that's great insight. You know, the 2.5 win thing is awesome. The $7 million per win, that's helpful compared to the market. One of the things that I don't have the math chops to do the actual numbers on, but something I think about a lot of the time with those kind of things too is not all wins are created equal. If you're a 91 win team or a 92 win team, those extra two wins are huge. That could be the difference between fighting for a wild card spot or having home field locked up in the wild card plenty early, or it could be the difference between a wild card and the division. The further up you are, the more those wins matter. So I think that that's a pretty straightforward side of Nimmo. Where the question marks come in, and this is something that is harder to quantify as well, is, well, okay, what if you only get 130 games of him or 120 games and the next injury declines his center field defense? We can't play out every one of those scenarios, but you wrote something pretty interesting in that piece, you know, and you also, I heard you talking about it on a podcast recently as well, that while we don't know a lot about how to project future injuries, there's at least a little bit of room for optimism with Nimmo. Is that correct?
I mean, first of all, the fact that we aren't that good at projecting is part of that optimism. You know what I mean? Because you would look at his track record and say he's only had two real full seasons out of the first six that he tried to have full seasons, and you'd say this guy can't do it. But we're actually not that good at looking at the past and predicting the future when it comes to injury. And the second part is the models that we do have, the stuff that we do know, says that the most recent information is the most important. And last year he had 151 games, was the healthiest he's ever been, and that's the most important information that we have with regards to his future health. So I tend to think that if the injury is what makes him the bargain, then I like it. And I think with some of the guys on this team, I know that there's been a real effort to take George Springer out of center field. He was maybe 30th by outs above average defensively. And I think that's what part of this interest is about. But I think putting Springer in there for a little bit, for a few weeks, if Nimmo has to go to the DL for a couple weeks, is not that big a deal. I think Whit Merrifield could spell him in center. And in general, finding a backup center fielder on the market or in your own system is not that hard. But yes, I do think this is a team that needs that extra couple of wins. And the Eric Swanson return is also really important because, yes, you could say, hey, why not keep Teoscar and sign Nimmo and sign a reliever? And I think what we've seen on the market, yeah, well, I mean, that's another thing. Like, that's a fan's thing. It's just sign all of them, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's just a reality that teams have a budget number that they can't go over. And on top of that, if you look at the relievers on the market right now, the market for relievers is insane.
Yeah.
You know, a guy as good as Swanson would cost them $35 million over 3 years. I think Swanson's better than Rafael Montero, who just signed a three-year, $30 million contract with the Astros. So they got Swanson, and that kept the money down that they're going to spend on the relievers, and that gives them a chance to go out there and get Nimmo.
I want to go back to what you were talking about when you talked about center field and right field and George Springer. And yes, defense is part of the discussion as far as having him play fewer games in center field, but also keeping him healthy, right? Like, I think yeah. People have this perception, and I don't know how much, again, like injury data, difficult to find, I suppose, or projections are difficult to find, but it does feel like you're more likely to have more wear and tear playing center field as far as the corners. Like, is there any data to back that up, or is that just something that feels right?
You know, it's only slightly, it's a slight difference, shortstop and center, just a slight difference. The reason why, though, I think it doesn't show up in the data is that your center fielder and your shortstop are usually the youngest players on your team. That's just a fact. So you could think of, like, yes, the play that they are the types of plays they're trying to make will get them hurt. We just saw the shortstop hit the center fielder. Those are the kinds of things that happen when you play defensively important positions. You play all out. So normally that's a younger player there, and maybe they can bounce back better, or they, you know, they avoid that, or, you know, for whatever reason, younger players do get hurt less. So Springer is an older center fielder, and so that's part of the equation there is older player that's more likely to get hurt because he's older, and he's also playing a tough position. That's a double whammy kind of.
You know, I have another one for you just in terms of projecting Nimmo, and this really doesn't have as much to do with injury as it does with the fact that Nimmo and Teoscar have somewhat similar production, but they come about it different ways, and they're roughly the same age, Nimmo coming in at about 6 months younger. Nimmo being a high OBP, moderate slugging guy versus Teoscar, who's a moderate OBP, high slugging guy. Do we have a sense of whether on base skill or power age differently or more gracefully than the other?
One thing I do know for sure is that the ability to make contact on pitches outside the zone ages terribly. It's one of the worst things that ages, and I think there's a couple names that should come to mind. Pablo Sandoval is one. Josh Hamilton is another. These are players that made a lot of bones on their ability to make contact, bad ball hitters. They were able to make contact on anything, and then that stopped, you know, and they just had an abrupt end to their career. And, you know, Brandon Nimmo is the kind of guy that top 20 in his chase rate and how often he swings at pitches outside the zone. Teoscar is more like bottom 20. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's the big difference there. I mean, yes, I prefer that Nimmo also hit the ball wicked hard like Teoscar did. But in terms of making good of the contact that he does, he's going to continue to make contact longer than Teoscar. And Teoscar's strikeout rates are already at a place where if they get much worse, you could see how he ends up going into a part-time role or ending up out of baseball quicker than somebody like Nimmo.
All right, what about Nimmo's defense? Because, you know, he played center field pretty well defensively this past year. Man, he played a lot of games, too. Just the second time in his career, as we've mentioned, has played over 100 games in his career. Is approaching his 30th birthday. He's just a little more than 3 years younger than George Springer, and we're realizing that George Springer at this point in his career is probably not best suited for that position. Is there any, like, is that pretty normal for a center fielder around their 33rd birthday to no longer have the chops to play that position defensively? How does Nimmo's defense project over the course of, I don't know, a 5 or 6 year deal?
Yeah, I don't think that Nimmo plays center field defense in the last couple of years of the deal. I mean, you're going to repeat the process in a way. Among qualified hitters last year, George Springer was the oldest center fielder. And just generally 30 to 32, you know, I think 31, 32, that's when you stop playing center field. It's a process that you can repeat at second, at shortstop, and you'll see the same thing. Among qualified players at shortstop, only over 30, you only had Miguel Rojas and Elvis Andrews. That were over 30, and Brandon Crawford the year before. So, you know, it is your early 30s when you stop being able to play shortstop defense and center field defense. But I think a little bit back to what Blake was saying about this is a team that wants to win now, you know? And so it's really, for them, a lot of it is just who's going to help us in center field best this next 2 years, you know? And then after that, you know, Nimmo can play left and Springer can play right, and hopefully – maybe our organization has produced a center fielder in the meantime, because that's really the best. That's what you want. You want a young. You need Bo Bichette. You want somebody to come up through your organization to play those, because they can only play until they're 31 or 32, and free agents are aged 29 to 30. I mean, it's a massive problem, actually.
The reason we're talking to Eno Saris about Brandon Nimmo as a potential fit for the Blue Jays is because, of course, they traded Teoscar Hernandez the other day for Eric Swanson and Adam Macko. Eric Swanson, you mentioned him briefly earlier, Eno, and said, you know, you like him better than a Rafael Montero type. I dug into, for anyone who doesn't know, Eno has this metric over at The Athletic called Pitching Plus, which takes a lot of different things into account and kind of splits pitching into stuff and location. So how good are the pitches? How well do you locate it? Eric Swanson grades out well by both of them. What do you like about what Swanson can bring to this Blue Jays bullpen, Eno?
He has a really good flat fastball. In terms of what you want out of fastball right now, people are always talking about vertical attack angle. And that just means that it comes in flat where the swing is coming in sort of angled, and that makes it harder to hit. But he also has a good three-pitch mix where both his split finger and slider are above average by stuff. And then just overall, he has better stuff than Montero, even though it might be hard to see it when you look at radar gun readings. You see Montero throwing harder, but the shapes that Swanson is dealing with are better, and the command is better. And I think that makes him a little bit more of a stable thing year to year. What you normally see with relievers, it's really hard to project year-to-year performance. But when you start talking about relievers that have both stuff and command, those are the guys that stick around a little bit longer. And for what it's worth, one of the guys that he profiles in terms of stuff and command, one of the guys he profiles really well next to, somebody that is in the same neighborhood, is Zach Pop. So it seems to me that the Blue Jays are saying, hey, we're not necessarily going to go for who's like, you know, Aroldis Chapman right now still has some of the stuff, but you saw what happens when you have zero command. Like, he was almost out of baseball. They left him off the playoff roster, Aroldis Chapman, because he still had okay stuff. He's still pretty good stuff, best stuff on the market, but zero command. And the Blue Jays are saying, hey, we're going to make Blue Jays part of what we care we're going to make part of what we care about with relievers, command as well as stuff. That's what you see with the acquisitions of Pop, I think even Simber, and with Swanson.
You know, if the Jays were to go after Nimmo at the terms we've kind of been kicking around, Ben and I were discussing a little earlier that, you know, budget wise, that might put them in the bargain bin from here when it comes to addressing their starting pitching depth. Right now, if the season were to start, Yusei Kikuchi and Mitch White would be firmly locked into rotation spots, and who the next man up would be is a little bit of a question mark. I know that you identified some pitchers in that same piece that we're talking about with your Brandon Nimmo analysis. And, you know, let's play out a scenario where even an Andrew Haney is a little out of the Jays' price range. Is there anyone below that level that you see having some value relative to, you know, the salaries that have been getting projected out there?
Yeah, you know, I have the level of the guys I like that have projected contracts on Fangraphs. And then I have the level where they don't even have a projected contract, so might be like a minor league deal. And I think that's actually ideal for this team. Nate Pearson has been pitching really well, but kind of more in reliever stints in winter ball. And so I think you throw him in the mix with Kikuchi and White. What you really want is to throw in one or two more guys in that mix and come out of spring training with somebody like Kikuchi in a hybrid role, you know, where he's your sixth starter, can give you three innings sometimes. You really want him in the pen. That's what I see for Kikuchi. Somebody like Michael Lorenzen or Matthew Boyd are pitchers that they don't pop with by stuff plus, but they do have decent command. And what I like about them both is they have multiple pitches. Matthew Boyd made some changes to his changeup so that it was above average last year. He didn't use it very much. What if he started using that more and he became more of a 3-4 pitch pitcher? Michael Lorenzen added a sweeper, which is a hot new pitch in baseball, very sort of a sideways curveball, and that was his best pitch last year, but he has like 5 or 6 pitches. So between Lorenzen and Boyd, you know, if you could get both, if you get two like that, that would be a really good deal. But even just getting one of those pushes Kikuchi into kind of sixth hybrid role spot, and I think I'd feel better about that. I, for one, am a guy that thinks that Berrios is going to bounce back.
Yes, if we had more time, I was going to ask you about that as well, because I know he was someone who was a bit of a results versus stuff outlier this past year. You know, I like the Lorenzen suggestion and that general analysis. Don't know if I can ever get past Matt Boyd having a 7 earned run, 0 out outing.
I was at that game
with the Blue Jays as a rookie. That might be tough to
almost an
to
all
shake
hitter.
Off.
He had a walk. It was almost an all hitter.
All hitter.
Unbelievable. Eno Saris of The Athletic, thanks so much for taking the time, man. Keep up the great work, and it's a Friday night, so I know you've got some cold ones ready to go.
Off to the beer store.
Off to the beer store. Thanks, Eno.
Thanks for having me.
It was Eno Saris of The Athletic. Yeah, that was my wife's birthday. No, it wasn't. Sorry, it wasn't her birthday. It was our anniversary.
I was going to say, oh, wow, your anniversary. Jeez, see, I was ready to make it was your ex-wife's birthday joke. And yeah, anniversary is even worse. Matt Boyd.
Yeah, I took her to the baseball game.
Oh, you want to go to the Red Sox game, sweetie? This prospect's making his second career start. It'll be so fun to watch.
Mark Carrig, a great writer for The Athletic as well, had, I thought, a hilarious piece on all hitters. Like, there's fewer all hitters in the history of Major League Baseball, like way fewer all hitters than there are no hitters, obviously.
And a couple close calls this year, it felt like.
Yeah, but that one was, I almost was able to say that I witnessed an all-hitter. An all-hitter is when the starting pitcher gives up nothing but hits and then departs. And
is there a term for hits and walks? Like we have, obviously, no-hitter and perfect game on the pitcher side. There's an all-hitter and then is...
Yeah, I know. It should be like an imperfect...
But that sounds like... just means better, you allowed one hit.
Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, that was quite a thing to not get a single out. Who would have figured that this guy would actually turn himself into a pretty valuable piece down the line, and there's been some injuries involved as well, and now, yeah, somebody's looking to reclaim him.
And hey, why not take another guy from the Seattle Mariners?
Sure,
I know the bulk of his career has been with Detroit, including the last time he was a starter, but he did work his way back as a pretty effective lefty reliever for Seattle this year. At a 1.35 ERA, just 13 innings, but not bad. And the strikeout rate came back up after a couple partial seasons there in Detroit.
No, he bounced back after that near all-hitter. All right, when we come back, we'll see if Aaron Rodgers can bounce back. Feels like it's on the verge of being over for him. We'll talk to Ross Tucker, the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. Get you set for Week 11 as the Fan Drive Time continues. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.